You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com National League Central Edition. We're hitting the midpoint of the season, a division that has three teams projected to win at least 89 games, including the St. Louis Cardinals on a 106-win pace, if you can believe that. The Pittsburgh Pirates closing some ground on them. A lot of good things going on in the National League Central as we head into the All-Star break. Jen's in Chicago for the four-game, three-day series against the Cubs. We'll try to give her some nice weather. Might have a little bit of rain, unfortunately. How you doing, Jen?
I'm doing great, Phil. I love coming to Chicago, so I think the weather will hopefully cooperate. You know, whatever we get here is probably going to be less rain than we've gotten in St. Louis recently, so it'll seem like a break to all of us who've been basically needing an arc to get around from home to ballpark the last few weeks.
Yeah, I hope so. You have it coming. We're talking about your Cardinals team that has been the best in the majors in the first half of the year on pace to win 106 games, and we really hit the real midpoint of the season with the All-Star break coming up in a week. So time to do a little quick review. Jen, from your standpoint, that 106-win pace the Cardinals are on, what's the best development they've had in the first half? What's worked the best?
I mean, it has to be their starting pitching. I mean, we think back to a couple months ago, mid-April, when we watched Adam Wainwright hobble off a field and then the next day find out that he had a torn Achilles and would be out for the year. And that just brought a lot of questions about what this rotation would be able to offer. I mean, certainly the Cardinals came in with, I think, what many considered one of the more formidable rotations in the National League. But to lose an ace, somebody of Adam Wainwright's stature, and to be putting up the numbers that this rotation has. I mean, we're talking well below a 3 ERA now halfway through the season, kind of historic proportions. And to look at who's doing it, I mean, certainly Lance Lynn, John Lackey have a track record, but for Michael Wacha to rebound from the arm injury he had last year to be pitching as he is, and then more than anyone, Carlos Martinez getting his first shot as an every fifth-day starter. He's pitched phenomenally. He has more quality starts than anybody else in this rotation. When you talk about all-stars, I think both Wacha and Martinez, regardless of who gets in, certainly had deserving candidacies. So what they've done pitching-wise has really been able to kind of mask some of the up-and-down offensive troubles that they've had. And to this point, this is a team that wins a lot of close games, a lot of low-scoring games. Now can their starting pitching continue at this pace? I think that's the biggest thing to look for as we head into the second half.
And as you look at the Cardinals right now and coming out of the first half, is there one area that you would say is the most the biggest cause of concern as they head toward the second half and try to maintain that pace?
Yeah, I mean, it is the offense right now. I mean, if you're looking for really specific, they're just really not getting any production right now from either of their corner infield spots. You know, for all the hot start that Matt Carpenter got off to in April, he really hasn't been the same player since he missed that time in early May with extreme fatigue. He's not getting the extra base hits that we're used to seeing him get. He's striking out at a very high rate for him. And then you look across the field over at first base, and the loss of Matt Adams is starting to show. You know, Mark Reynolds, he's done okay filling in. We're not seeing the power necessarily that Mark has shown in the past. And those strikeouts, as they often do for him, are also starting to pile up. So Cardinals getting very little production from two positions that really they were counting a lot on. I do think, getting healthy in this team looks like it will get a little bit healthier after the All-Star break, obviously barring any other injuries. Matt Holliday coming back, Jordan Walding getting close to coming back. The Cardinals hope John Jay and Matt Belisle, who recently went on the DL, won't be out for long. And hopefully some of the troubles or some of the weak points that they've had will be addressed by getting players back. But offensively, it's just been hard to gain a lot of traction for this team for whatever reason. And it's a little surprising because when you looked coming into the season, it looked like the Cardinals had built themselves to have a really balanced top-to-bottom lineup. And, to this point, we've just seen that from time to time, but not consistently.
Well, you mentioned Matt Holliday. Do you expect him back this week when the Cardinals play a very interesting series at Pittsburgh in the first half? Do you expect Matt to be back in left field for that series? And how important do you think getting him back will be? Should fans temper their expectations, or could his return be a huge jolt for the lineup that has struggled in the last week or 10 days to produce runs?
Yeah, so the first point, I mean, Matt is certainly eyeing coming back for that weekend series in Pittsburgh. You know, here in Chicago, beginning on Monday, he's going to do some more agility work, some kind of cutting with his running, a little more sprinting, slowly build that up. And if all responds well with his quad, then the expectation is that he plays in Pittsburgh this weekend and also plays in the All-Star game. You know, it's not lost on him that this is the first time in his career that he's been a fan-elected starter, which is a little bit surprising when you look at the numbers he's put up for many, many years. But, you know, he appreciates that honor, and he does want to play in the All-Star game. So if he's able to get back this weekend, I think we'll see him there. What this means for the team, I don't think you can understate what he can bring to this club. You know, we talk about kind of the potential for a deep lineup. He's going to do that. He's going to fill back into that three spot that's going to allow the Cardinals to bump Johnny Peralta likely back into the cleanup spot. And it's just going to lengthen a lineup that, again, has had a lot of holes in it recently. You know, and what it's also going to do is create a situation where the Cardinals have to figure out who their center field option is. We've seen Randall Grichuk play almost exclusively in that spot in left field for the last month. He started off really well, hasn't played that well, is probably for about the last week or so. And then we've seen Tommy Pham come up this weekend and have a really big weekend. So how the Cardinals kind of use those two guys in center field along with Peter Borges, I think, is a little bit of a question. But certainly, if Matt Holliday can come back near the form that he was for the first two-plus months of the season when he was on base nearly every game, that's a big boost for a lineup that really needs a spark at this time.
Well, and you referenced earlier, Mark Reynolds has done a good job since Matt Adams went down with the season-ending injury. What kind of signals are you getting from the front office now with the trade deadline getting a little bit nearer about the possibility of going out and trading for a significant bat at first base, you know, a left-handed hitter to replace Matt Adams, or just a significant move elsewhere?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because we talk about how good the starting pitching has been and how kind of the biggest question marks are on offense. However, every indication I've got is that the Cardinals are still looking for starting pitching. And it makes sense. You know, despite how good they have been, you look at the fact that there's not a lot of depth right now. Certainly the loss of Wainwright, you know, weakens that. And then with Marco Gonzalez not having been healthy for most of the first half in AAA, the Cardinals don't necessarily have him waiting in case there were an issue in the major league rotation. And then also to consider is the fact that both Michael Wacha and Carlos Martinez are having their workload, you know, pretty scrutinized by the Cardinals. These are guys who have never approached 200 innings in their career, and both are on pace right now to exceed 200 innings. So at some point in the second half, we're going to see the Cardinals pull back, possibly skip starts here and there or do something to get creative, because the last thing they want is for Martinez and or Wacha to have to stop pitching in September and not be available in October. So, you know, getting a starting pitcher to add both to the depth, to add, you know, to the intervening sort of thing, I think right now remains the priority for the Cardinals. Now, certainly they're going to look for some offensive help. Not sure how much is out there, particularly at first base, which is an area that the Cardinals could potentially upgrade. A left-handed bat, sure, they're going to look for it. I'm just not sure that they're going to get an impact bat in the next few weeks. I think the bigger move would probably be on the starting pitching side.
One last thing, Jen, and then we'll let you go on last year's trade deadline, a deal that in some ways seemed like a head-scratcher, or certainly a surprise when the Cardinals added John Lackey from the Red Sox along the same lines, trading for a starting pitcher when it's the strength of your team to begin with. 26 starts Lackey's made for the Cardinals, 9-8, 3.67 trade, just or 3.67 ERA going into a start against his old Boston friend John Lester in Chicago. How significant has Lackey been, and what was the reaction a year ago about that trade? It seemed like it wasn't that popular in St. Louis.
Yeah, you know, it's funny thinking back that it has almost been a year, and I'll probably never forget that day in San Diego, and it was a stunned clubhouse to begin with, you know, just the Cardinals. And I think it wasn't so much that they weren't excited about getting John Lackey. It was that, you know, Alan Craig and Joe Kelly, both very well-liked teammates, both guys who had climbed through this organization, had a lot of very good friends who they had climbed with, were having to say goodbye. So, you know, it was certainly a sullen kind of atmosphere. And it probably took a few days for that to kind of pass and for the Cardinals to realize that, hey, you know, we got a pretty good starting pitcher with a very good track record in return. You look at John Lackey and what he has meant to the team, and the fact that he's also pitching for the major league minimum, I mean, it's been a coup for the Cardinals, the trade that they made last year. And also when you look at the struggles that both Joe Kelly and Alex Gregg have had over in Boston. So, you know, when we talk about the Cardinals needing pitchers who can eat up innings, who can be reliable, I mean, John Lackey tops that list. So he's certainly given the Cardinals much more than they're paying for. And two, I mean, you look at his ability to just be a workhorse through start to finish and into October, and that's certainly going to be valuable, again, as the season gets closer to the end.
Joined by Cubs beat writer Kerry Muscat, we had some beautiful July 4th weather here in Chicago. Did you get to enjoy the weekend at all, Kerry?
Well, I was at the ballpark, so I guess, yeah, it was. It's always fun to be at Wrigley when the place is packed and the weather's good and the Cubs win. It's always makes my work life a little more interesting.
How about the fireworks at Wrigley Field? How interesting was that to see?
To be perfectly honest, I didn't see them because if you consider the timing, the fireworks went off as we were all going downstairs to get to Madden and talk to the starting pitcher, so we never saw them. But in talking to the ushers and the people that did see them and everyone else, they said they were really, really well done. And I'm hoping they do it again sometime soon and don't have to wait for the holiday.
Yeah. Next time, ask for the day off so you can watch them.
Yeah.
Hey, I just looking at this Cubs team, we are getting to the statistical midpoint of the season, and in the first year of Joe Madden, the Cubs are on pace to win 89 games and would be a wild card team as we speak. When you look back at the first half of the season, Kerry, what would you point to as the best development that's allowed this team to go from being a way up the track also ran to all of a sudden a team that has a reason to take itself seriously?
Well, the pitching has been really good. Jake Arrieta has really emerged and done well, and Kyle Hendricks has had a couple good starts and finally getting back on track. Jason Hamill also has just been really solid, and if I don't think I ever would have thought that they would be doing this well without John Lester contributing more. Not that he hasn't contributed, but contributing more. I think that's kind of the biggest surprise for me in the first half.
Yeah, it's certainly been a strong deep, with the exception still working to get that fifth starter, but. We're going to get to Clayton Richard in a minute. Before we get there, when you look at where the Cubs are at this point, is there an area that you point to that would say maybe they can be a 90-plus win team if they can do this better in the second half?
Well, a lot of it's going to depend just on the kids. You know, it's going to depend on how Chris Bryant and Addison Russell and Jorge Soler make adjustments as they go into the second half of the season. Russell's been in a little bit of a funk recently. Soler just came back off of the disabled list, and Bryant has been a little streaky, although I really can't complain too much with him hitting .279, so I don't think that's horrible. But Russell's really, really struggled a little bit. What Madden tells us is that he likes the second baseman's mechanics at the plate. He's just not been able to come through with some hits, and he's in a little bit of a funk. So we'll see. I really think it's going to – how they go is going to depend on the kids, and they have to and fans just have to be prepared that it's going to be a lot of ups and downs with these guys as they learn big league pitching and as big league pitching learns about them too.
Well, as we're talking, the Cubs have continued to scuffle to score runs. They scored two or less in 10 of the last 12 games, but somehow gone 6-6, including a 5-1 run since Joe Madden had that magician visit the clubhouse in New York. To me, bigger than the magician would be getting Jorge Soler back in the lineup, which the Cubs did over the weekend. How big of a factor do you think Soler can be in getting the run production turned around, and just in general for the second half? This is a guy that in Arizona, you know, people would have thought would stack up with Bryant statistically and maybe with Rizzo in terms of run production. I know that's a lot to put on a rookie's shoulders, But based on how he hit in 2014, you know, it seems like he's almost become a guy that could be, a secret weapon or almost like you get a guy off injury and it's like going and making a big trade.
Well, he could be, but it depends again on whether or not he can, you know, how he handles the pitching. I mean, he did do well in May. He had 288 before he was hurt, then he had the sprained ankle. They felt that the time off may have helped him because it gave him some time to work on his hitting a little bit, work with the hitting coaches, do a lot of one-on-one stuff, get stronger with his legs, which has been kind of an ongoing problem. So I he could be a great pickup. It could be like getting a big bat there. Madden likes the fact that he lengthens the lineup out. You know, when you put Soler and Rizzo and Bryant in there and whatever combination he does, you know, it could be really powerful. Again, it just depends on, you know, can he stop the strikeouts? You know, can he make more contact? And I know that he's working hard. It's just a matter of, you know, he's inexperienced, and that inexperience just kind of keeps holding him back.
Well, the one area that's been a bit of a revolving door for the Cubs has been that fifth starter spot, and they four guys had done it with an ERA of almost 8 before they opened the door to Clayton Richard on July 4th, a guy they picked up from the Pirates because the Pirates didn't have room for him in the big league rotation, usually opt-out clause. Is there any reason to really temper the excitement about Clayton Richard, given, I mean, he threw 6 1/3, gave up 2 runs, but just looked so solid doing it on Saturday night? Is there a feeling like maybe the Cubs have answered that, or is it still like let's wait and see how he does over a few weeks or a month before we anoint him as a regular part of the rotation?
Well, I know Theo Epstein has talked a lot leading up to the trade deadline about how they may not make like a huge splash, but maybe acquire players more like a Clayton Richard. And this might be actually this might be the secret weapon in terms of their pitching, you know, who could come in and help. Really solid pitcher. The good thing for him is that he's healthy. He's had 2 surgeries on his shoulder. The most recent one was in July 2013, and he hadn't pitched in the big league since June of 2013. Miguel Montero was saying the other day that he hated to face Richard, just hated to face him because he has a really heavy sinker, and he could be a really good fit for Wrigley Field here. So it might be that he's kind of the secret weapon. The Cubs really need some depth in their starting pitching. You know, Watt has been hurt. I think they were counting a lot on some of the kids like Eric Jokic and Dallas Buehler. Those two have been hurt, and they're kind of coming back in the minors. Justin Turner is pretty much out for the year, so he's not a factor. They thought they had enough depth, and they don't. So I think Richard might be a real nice surprise here. I'm not sure he'll get another start before the All-Star break because they have an off day in the week before the break. I think they're still kind of sorting out the rotation a little bit, but it'll be interesting to see where he fits in. I know, you know, with his days with the Padres, I know Jed Hoyer knows him well, and he was pretty excited about the guy. It's just what's really cool is if you see a player who thought that he might be out of the game, might have been done, and to see him have such a great outing on Saturday, and he even said that coming off the field to the ovation that he got, he's never gotten that before. So it's just a really good story. It's just a really good story.
One last question. Any updates on the mysterious Rafael Soriano? And do you think Joe Madden could continue to go, the rest of the season, really, kind of balancing and juggling the arms in the bullpen? Or do you think there's a need to identify a closer again? And whether it's Rafael Soriano, name Mott the closer, or just kind of keep doing what they're doing.
You know, if I thought that any of these guys had egos, I would say yes, he needs to pick one. But this might be the most egoless bullpen I've ever seen. There's no, I mean, Hector Rondon is still, he's just really happy with a good outing. He doesn't need the save to justify it. Mott is happy contributing any way that he can. Strope, you could bring him in the sixth inning in a key moment, or you could bring him in the ninth inning, and it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just really actually fun to watch. Soriano, apparently his arrival was delayed because of paperwork and his visa. That has been clarified, and he should be going to the Cubs complex in Mesa very soon. And then the plan was to have him pitch at the AA level and then the AAA level just to kind of get in some game action and then move up. Madden has been joking that Soriano was facing some of his uncles and cousins down in the Dominican to get ready. I think he might need a little fiercer competition. But he's not projected as the closer. I can see Madden just going with this, I hate to say closer by committee because it's not really that. It's just whoever he feels is the right guy at that time, and that's what he's going with. So it could go this way the rest of the season. There's no egos here, and the guys seem pretty cool with it.
Yeah, it's working very well, and Neil Ramirez also working back into it as well. As always, joined by Pittsburgh native intrepid Pirates beat reporter Tom Singer. How you doing, Tom?
Doing good, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing very well, coming out of a great July 4th weekend, heading toward the All-Star Game and the trade deadline. Always an interesting time in baseball. But as we talk, the Pirates have just hit the real midpoint of the season. They're on pace to win 94 games. That'll match their total from a couple years ago and be the most since 1992. Looking back at that first half, Tom, what would you point to for the best development for the Pirates in getting on this 94 win pace?
Well, it has to be the depth and consistency of the starting rotation, no doubt. You know, the offense still has a very really high ceiling, but it's been pretty sporadic. But that rotation has put up some amazing runs, and it's enabled a team to go on some extended winning streaks, which is, you know, you need to have those dependable starters to go on any long sustained winning streak. And that's basically what they've gotten from Garrett Cole, AJ Burnett, Francisco Liriano, Charlie Morton, once he came back in late May. And, you know, Jeff Locke is, you know, you get the good luck or the bad luck ultimately. But when he's been on, he's been very, very good.
And as the Pirates head into this home series against the Cardinals to close out the first half, what would they point to that could be an area to improve for the second half? You know, cut down this deficit with the Cardinals that was 9 games at one point, but the Pirates have reduced that some, but still looking at a big deficit. How do they make up that ground?
Well, they make up the ground by picking up some additional offense, but almost without doubt, they are looking for that improvement from in-house. As I said, the offense has been sporadic, but everybody who has underperformed certainly has it within himself to do better. And in fact, in the last 2-3 weeks, you know, some of those cooler bats have started to come around. Namely, the double play combination, Jordy Mercer and Neil Walker, have gotten hot simultaneously. You know, Gregory Polanco remains sort of a dark cloud in right field. He just hasn't swung the bat with any consistency. And Pedro Alvarez, you know, his overall numbers are basically, you know, Pedro Alvarez level, but he has also been very productive the last, you know, the last week as we approached this last week before the All-Star break. So those guys maintain the level of performance that they've shown the last couple of weeks, and the guys who have been swinging well, you know, McCutcheon, Starling Marte, Francisco Cervelli, if they maintain where they've been, this lineup can produce some big innings on a consistent basis.
Hey, what's the level of concern about Marte's health? I mean, the report I saw when he left the game over the weekend was an oblique, which always can be bad. What's the level of concern there with him?
Well, that's the first time I heard the word oblique. He did some discomfort on his side. He's going to be reevaluated at some point today, and we'll get an update on him before tonight's game. But obviously, if it does turn out to be an oblique, which is very likely given the area that he felt the discomfort, then that could be an extended absence. As you know, obliques are very fickle. You have to give them plenty of time to totally heal because they're very easy to re-aggravate. And if they have to do without Marte for any extended period of time, that's a major hit to this team. But I have not heard any updates since he left the game yesterday, and looking forward to getting some medical, trainer re-evaluation, where he's at. He said the same kind of discomfort a couple of years ago when he did not miss that many games. So hopefully it's just, it's not oblique, just some other muscular issue.
Another thing we'll learn more about a little bit later after we get through the podcast is the All-Star selections, but I cannot envision a scenario where Mark Melancon will not be on the National League All-Star team. You're talking about a guy that's the save leader with 27 saves. And as always, it seems, his ERA south of 2. Looking at Melancon, Tom, I mean, this is a guy that when the Pirates got him, I'm not sure they knew what they were getting, but you look at 3 years with the Pirates after what was kind of a nightmare run for Melancon in Boston, a 1.63 ERA and 76 saves for his time in Pittsburgh. How big has he been to the Pirates' success, and who do you give the most credit to for the Pirates finding a very reliable closer without giving up the farm to get him? Is it the coaches for developing him or the front office for getting him in the first place?
Well, it's the coaches. I remember when Mark came over before the 2013 season, he made a comment 1 month into spring training that he had learned more about pitching in that first month around the Pirates than he had learned in his entire career. A lot of that credit goes to Jim Benedict, who is a special advisor in the GM office, and especially is pitching, as well as the major league pitching coach, Ray Surridge. When they got him from Boston, they knew what they were getting. They were getting a backup in case Jason Grilli did not work out as a closer, which he did for a season and a half. And then when they decided to move on from Grilli, sure enough, Melancon stepped in and inherited that job and did a tremendous, and has been doing a tremendous job. They especially wanted Melancon included in the deal. There was the deal that St. Joel Hanrahan to Boston, specifically because they wanted a fallback in case they needed somebody else to step in as a closer. And obviously it's worked out tremendously. And the most impressive thing about Melancon, he leads the league in saves, and I still believe he's one of the most underrated closers in the majors just because of his personality. He's not very flashy. He doesn't overpower hitters, obviously. So his cutter will top out at 91, 92 miles an hour. But he's absolutely invaluable. As far as the All-Star, by the time people hear this, I'm sure they know who's been picked. I have absolutely no insight, but I've got a feeling he will not be on the team but might be one of the final vote candidates. The guys that I expect Pirates to be added to the team by the players' vote and manager Bruce Bochy are McCutcheon, Garrett Cole, and even most likely A.J. Burnett. That's just my feeling. I have absolutely no advanced knowledge, but that's kind of where I stand.
Well, I'll demand a recount if Melancon doesn't win the players' vote for closer. You're right, he's not flashy. He's not Aroldis Chapman. Who you think would probably be on that team, even though he hasn't had the save totals, given the red struggles. But here's the stat I like on Melancon, Tom. To go along with 8.4 strikeouts per 9 innings, so he's still coming in and getting strikeouts, he's walked only 1.3 per 9 innings for his 3 years in the Pirates. I mean that's what you got to have for a closer that won't come in and put himself in trouble with a walk, pounds it, and makes the other team beat him. Just, to me, a perfect formula.
Yeah, and he doesn't give up the long ball. He's given up two or three this season, which is like triple what he gave up last season. But over, you know, obviously overall, it's a very distinguished figure. He makes his strikeouts have picked up the last couple of weeks when he's picked up a little velocity on that cutter back into the low 90s. But he primarily gets people to beat that cutter in into the ground. Clint Hurdle made a really good point just the other day. What amazes him about, you know, we've been hearing a lot of talk about exit velocity on balls being struck. He didn't give us a figure, but he challenged us to look at the exit velocity on any ball that's hit on off Melanson. Nobody can barrel up his cutter, lefty or righty.
Yeah, he's been getting the job done. One last quick thing, because the Pirates' starting pitching has been so good, they've only needed six starting pitchers. They didn't have a way to really move Clayton Richard up from AAA, so he used his opt-out clause, and a trade was worked out to send him to the Cubs. He pitched very well on July 4th in his Cubs debut. What were the feelings about Richard as he left the Pirates? And is there any concern that he goes to a team that is a contender from the same division?
Well, there has to be some concern in that regard, but obviously they had no choice. Once the Cubs expressed interest in him, with the way his upward mobility clause read, the Pirates had to let him go to the Cubs. Two ways of looking at that. Obviously, being with the Cubs, he'll face the Cardinals as well multiple times. But he'll also face the Pirates. You know what? The Bucks were pretty happy with that, and I'll tell you why. They figured it might even help them down the road when pitchers in similar situations are shopping for a team to go to. As much success as they had rehabilitating pitchers for themselves, like Liriano, Burnett, they figured that they got their reputation in place now, and even though they couldn't hold on to Richard, they did do with him what they pledged to do, getting back to the majors. And when you look down the road, a similar situation comes up, they figure they'll have an inside track on getting the next upside, rehab pitcher.
Well, I'm sure they're right about that because they do have that reputation. So nice job by Jim Benedict and everybody else. I know there's a lot of guys involved with the success they've had besides Ray Searidge and the other obvious people in getting arms healthy and up and running in the big leagues. We got a treat today. We're joined by Brewers broadcaster Joe Block, filling in for the inimitable Adam McAlvey. Lord only knows what Adam's off doing. But, Joe, how are you doing? Thanks for doing this.
Well, I'll have you know that Adam and I are separated in age by 10 days, so hopefully our perspectives will be about the same.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if I'd want to have Adam's perspective, but that's your free will. Looking right now, it's just a tick past the middle point of the season. We're talking about a Brewers team that is 13 games under 500 and on pace to finish 69-93. Joe, when you look back at a first half that's been this disappointing, what would you point to as sort of the worst development, the underpinning that kind of set the stage for that 4-17 start they've been trying to get out from under?
Yeah, that's really what was it, Phil, is, if you look back at the first half, you really got to look back at the first two quarters. And, that first quarter of the season, the team got off to a terrible start. It was under performance. And then injuries set in after that. So at first it was not injuries. It was just the team wasn't playing well, and then injuries made things hard to get out from underneath. And then over the last, maybe 5-6 weeks or so, this club has actually played pretty well. They're 20-15 over their last 35 games. So now they're progressing to the mean. They're playing like the team that they probably thought that they were going to have at least a 500 ball club, and maybe if things go right, a little bit better. But, after that, first 40 games or so, the Brewers have put themselves in quite a hole.
Yeah. In addition to the stretch, that you referenced, as we're doing this show, they've won 11 of the last 14. And really continued that progress. What would you point to as the best development for the first half of the year? I know it has been sort of a trail of injuries, and Carlos Gomez, a guy that so much was expected of, as hasn't been able to really keep it together on the field to get a long streak going. But Ryan Braun producing. What would you say has been the best thing that's happened that's allowed them to get this thing turned around a little bit?
Yeah, I think the best thing has been a couple of their acquisitions. One at the trade deadline last year, Gerardo Parra, who's been sensational among the league leaders in batting average. He's been outstanding defensively, and he's been a consistent, upbeat presence in the clubhouse, which has not been an easy thing to do all the time. Adam Lind looks like he might drive in 100 runs this year and has been steady enough over at first base, and he's been healthy. These were all question marks coming into the season, his defense and his health. And through the first half of the season, he's been great at those. And then a youngster, Taylor Youngman, who's come out of Brewer's first-round pick, who was filled in for the injured Willie Peralta in their rotation. He's been really good, an ERA in the low twos. And the Brewers were just hoping that he could fill some innings if needed when there inevitably is an injury to the starting rotation. And he's been more than that. He's been a guy that you want to have stay in the rotation now. So I think those three guys individually have been a really positive positive showings in that first half.
Well, right out of the chute on May 4th, if my record's right here, Ron Renneke stepped aside was fired as manager, and Craig Counsell appointed to replace him. The Mariners, 29-31 under Craig. What would you say we've learned about Craig Counsell as a manager, Joe?
Well, you know, 60 games into a tenure is probably a little bit difficult to really assess anything. I think we'll know a lot more once he goes through a spring training and helps, kind of put his stamp on the way things are going to have happened. But, you know, I think some of it has to do with just, you know, the club getting healthy. And that's why they've gone back. You know, Ron Renneke wasn't a bad manager. He wasn't a bad guy or anything like that. Craig Counsell is also an outstanding person. And you know, we'll see his acumen as a manager, which I think will be very good too, once the Brewers play some meaningful ballgames. But right now, you know, it's hard to really get a gauge because the Brewers have been so far back in the standings.
Yeah, absolutely understandable. One thing that has marked the Brewers franchise, certainly in the Miller Park era, the big crowds at Miller Park, even though this has been a tough season, still 11th in Major League with an average of almost 32,000, a franchise that drew over 3 million when it was last a playoff team in 2011. Huge support from the community. How do you judge kind of the will of the fan base at this point in a division that is seems to have been always been challenging and becoming more challenging with the St. Louis Cardinals showing no signs of going away, the Pittsburgh Pirates strong as always, third straight year, and now the Cubs kind of emerging with some young players as a team that could establish themselves on the in future seasons. Does the fan base have a will to rebuild, or do you think it's going to want to take its best shot year in, year out?
Well, you can't really win that way unless you have a big payroll and meaning going for year in and year out. You just can't do that. So you've got to have a terrific farm system to be able to bolster those guys and supplement free agent signings. And I think folks here know that. I mean, there's no secret Milwaukee's one of the two smallest markets in baseball, but it doesn't mean that it needs to be sparsely attended the games, because Brewers fans, as I'll tell you, are as good as any fans in baseball, and I think they're the best, because you think about this the size of the market and the fans that come out here and the size of the crowds every night, even on a Monday night. Last night, the Brewers draw 25,000 fans on a Monday, and for a last place ball club, but they haven't played like a last place ball club lately, and so I think that's all they're looking for. They want a team that plays hard, and it gives them a chance to win every night. And if they're not atop the standings right away for a while, that's okay with them, as long as they're playing hard and that they know that things are moving in the right direction.
But none of us really know the specifics or have a crystal ball to say, but would you expect the Brewers to be busy at the deadline, maybe trading some established pieces that don't fit long term and trying to make good trades like they have in the past.
Yeah, Phil, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't. Even despite the team playing better lately, they're still so far out of any sort of contention for this season that it wouldn't really make a whole lot of sense to stand pat or to try to add. And especially this is the season's, I should say, the franchise's highest payroll in history. So there really isn't a whole lot of room to add to it to begin with. So it only points to trying to move players, but, you know, Doug Melvin has shown in the past, he's not going to just move guys for the sake of moving guys. You know, if teams are willing to give the Brewers a piece or pieces to help them rebuild and rebuild quickly, or retool, or whatever phrase you want to use, I think then he would be open to that. But, of course, as you know, things don't really start to heat up until we get right to the final moments of that deadline. But I think the Brewers will be one of the few teams that have some really good pieces that's willing to sell.
Hey, Joe, last question, and then we'll let you go. When you look at the Brewers roster, and don't give me two or three guys, just find the one. If you're going to point to one guy that would be a second-half key on the field, continuing this improvement and making it an exciting second half in Milwaukee, who's that guy?
Well, I'll put it this way. I think the guy that can improve the most is Kyle Loesch. He has the highest ERA in baseball, and you would never have expected that coming into this season. You know, over the last 4 years, his ERA is about half of what it is now this year. And so command has been an issue for him. He's given up 20 home runs already. Most of those have been with men on base. And so, you look at Kyle Loesch and say, he looks like the same pitcher. He's just quite literally throwing the ball over the plate instead of on the corners more often than he has in recent years. And so he's been virtually ineffective in most of his starts. You just want to keep the club in the ballgame. He hasn't done that very often. But he's the kind of guy, he's a great leader, he's a great clubhouse presence, and he's been very, very successful in Major League Baseball, even last year or the year before or the year before that. So you expect him to try to return to that at some point. We haven't seen it yet, but if he does, that's going to really solidify the Brewers' rotation.
Joe, thank you very much. As always, joined by Mark Sheldon. Mark's in Washington as the Reds close out the first half of the season against the Nationals and then on to Miami for a series against the Marlins. How you doing, Mark?
Bill, I'm doing fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing great, coming off a good July 4th here in Chicago. And as we're talking tonight, the Reds will reach the mathematical midpoint of the season, so why wait until the All-Star break to review the first half? I know it's not been the one that was drawn up there in Cincinnati. Right now the Reds projecting to 73 wins and expected to be sellers of talent after the All-Star break. When you look back to the first half, what would you say has been the biggest disappointment?
A great question. I don't even know exactly where to begin. I guess it would say the offense, in a lot of ways, has not been what was expected. I think you kind of knew there would be some challenges with the pitching staff, losing two starting pitchers. You knew the bullpen may have a little bit of trouble, but you really did expect the lineup to have more production and be more consistent because of all the talent they had. And some of it was wrecked because of injuries, but also a lot of it was just wrecked because guys didn't have the kind of a seasons they expected so far. It's been better than it was in April and part of May, but I think that when they go back and do the autopsy on the first half, that's going to be something that really, really shows up as, wow, they didn't get the production they really wanted. I mean, you have Billy Hamilton, the leadoff hitter, now batting ninth behind the pitcher. Joey Votto has had a good season, but not a great Joey Votto season. Jay Bruce is still trying to find himself. There's just been a few guys that have not performed well. Todd Frazier, of course, has been doing very well, but he hasn't had enough people to join him.
Well, that middle infield, Brandon Phillips in and out of injuries, and Zach Cozart playing well and then lost. So it does seem like the it's been sort of all over the field, and a big injury behind the plate too. So, yeah, they have sort of taken it everywhere. When you do look at that team, though, what would you say has gone right? What would you say has been the best thing about the first half?
Well, definitely Todd Frazier. He's having what could be a historic season as far as the Reds are concerned. He's on pace for 50 homers, more than 40 doubles, and he'd be the first Red hitter ever to do 40 doubles and 40 homers in a season. He's played really well defensively. He obviously is going to start now in the All-Star game. He's a nice success story. You look at a guy on kind of a less heralded one is J.J. Hoover, who had an absolute disaster of a season in 2014. He lost 10 games in a row, had an ERA in, you know, around 5. And this year, you could make a case for him that he does deserve a nod to the All-Star game, even though I don't think he'll get one. But he's had a sensational year. He's taken over as the eighth inning guy after a lot of other people did not do the job. And I think, you know, he'll be a quieter success story, but he definitely deserves some recognition.
I know this is going to be a hard thing to sum up, but if you could put this into just a limited number of words, how do you think, how are fans looking at where the franchise is now? I think from 10,000 feet away, you look at it and you see Cueto last year of contract, Leak last year of contract. Certainly with Cueto, contract too big for the team payroll. Leak, who knows? You know, I would think both guys would be shopped and traded at some point after the All-Star game. How are fans looking at that?
Well, you kind of see it through two different prisms. You see it from just general fandom, which I think is mixed. I think there's still a lot of fans that are very supportive of the team. But at the same time, they're also realistic that things aren't going well and that it's time to sell. And then you look through the prism of Twitter, which is almost entirely negative, at least from the feedback I get. And they've been wanting to sell since before spring training started. So it's, I think a lot of fans in overall, both through social media and just in, you know, in encountering people, I think are ready to move on to next year in a lot of ways, even though the Reds are not that far below 500 and they're not necessarily out of the wild card race. I think they're already looking to see what the team can do in terms of rebuilding. And I think they've already kind of prepped themselves for the loss of some significant talent. I'm not sure how significant it's going to be. They still really haven't tipped their hand of where they're going to go. Bob Castellini remains an X factor. He's been very opposed to selling in the past, so it'll be interesting to see what they do. But I think some fans have just said, okay, let's move on to 2016, see what the rebuilding can bring, and they hope it's not too long of a rebuilding. I think sometimes when fans ask for rebuilding, they don't have to be careful what they wish for, because some teams rebuild perpetually, so you don't want that if you're a fan of the Reds.
If the Reds do trade the starting pitchers, it'll open up spots, and there was talk in the last week about Tony Cingrani having an opportunity to move back in the rotation and get stretched out and get another good look as a starting pitcher. I wonder, I mean, Aroldis Chapman, you also hear his name in trade rumors, but he's under the Reds' control through 2016. Could you ever see the Reds giving Aroldis Chapman a look as a starting pitcher?
I used to think that they would a couple years ago. I really thought it was something that could have happened and maybe should have happened. But I think now it's past that now. I don't see the Reds and making Chapman into a starter. He loves closing. He loves the ninth inning. He's been opposed to it almost from the beginning. I think once they kind of gave him a taste of what closing was like, I don't think he ever wanted to go back. So, no, I don't see him starting again.
Hey, we mentioned Todd Frazier made the late push to get past Matt Carpenter and grab that starting third baseman spot on the National League All-Star team. Wire-to-wire, good player, good in the field, you know, having this potentially record-setting season in some ways at the plate. It seems to me it's just been steady development for him. But is there anything you can point to for a key to how when not much has gone right around him in the lineup, he's been able to keep his, focus, cool, whatever, and not get dragged down, that he's having a big season when the others around him are struggling?
I think for him, in the more subjective way of evaluating, he's very confident. And he's one of those guys, I've really rarely ever seen him get down on himself. or if he is, it's a very temporary time. He never is afraid of going out there and trying to do better. As far as on the baseball side, he has a very unorthodox swing that some people have called ugly or whatever you want to call it, but it does work for him, and he's able to have some, even on those pitches that are away from the strike zone, he seems to have a plan that he can go reach down and go after some of these really bizarre pitches that pitchers try to beat him with, and he can hit it, whether it's with one hand. One time several years ago, it was with no hands. He can do a lot of things, and he still has a lot of power, and Great American Ballpark, of course, helps a little bit. But he's able, even on the road, to maximize the strike zone by being able to hit a lot of different places and hit to all fields. And I think that really helps him a lot. Even though he can pull it, I've seen him go the other way, too, and it seems to work for him.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Enjoy the run-up to the All-Star game and the rare chance to cover the All-Star game from the host writer's perspective. I know you'll be a busy man. Thanks for listening. This is Phil Rogers. This has been MLB.com Extras, National League Central Edition.